Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the conviction of Osama bin Laden's son-in-law on terrorism charges in a federal court in New York that the Attorney General Eric Holder considers a vindication, saying it was appropriate that this defendant, who publicly rejoiced over the attacks on the World Trade Center, faced trial in the shadow of where those buildings once stood. A human rights lawyer representing prisoners detained at Guantanamo, David Reams, joins us to discuss whether this conviction will lead to the closing of Guantanamo, something the president has pledged to do that the Republicans in Congress have blocked. Then we'll examine the effectiveness of the EU and US sanctions on Putin's Russia and what might be on the agenda when Obama meets with the Saudis on Friday. Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and author of Engaging the Muslim World, joins us to discuss whether the Saudis could squeeze the Russian economy and punish Putin for keeping the Assad regime alive in Syria by flooding the market with oil as they did after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And with General Sisi announcing he's running for president of Egypt, we'll look into how long the Saudis can prop up Egypt's military government. Then finally, we will speak with Elizabeth Widra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, who witnessed the Supreme Court's deliberations over whether a business can opt out of the Affordable Care Act's mandate to provide contraception coverage for female employees based on religious objections. We'll discuss the likely consequences of a ruling in favor of the evangelical Christian family-owned business whose owners are imposing their religious beliefs on their employees, and whether this will lead to more state laws allowing businesses not to serve LGBT customers based on religiously sanctioned bigotry. And joining us now is David Reams, a human rights lawyer representing 16 Yemeni prisoners detained at Guantanamo, a former partner at Covington & Burling. He is known for his litigation on human rights and civil liberties cases, including the First Amendment challenge to the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Reams.
Welcome to you.
And the jury that found Suleiman Abu Ghaith guilty in New York, and then, of course, he's a fairly high up subject, being the son-in-law of Osama bin Laden, which, by the way, was not mentioned in the trial for some reason or other, that he married bin Laden's daughter Fatima years after the September 11 attacks. But the Attorney General's using this or making the case that this vindicates his efforts to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in a federal court in New York, as opposed to having him locked up in Guantanamo before a military commission that still is yet to meet. So do you think that this is perhaps the beginning of the end of Guantanamo?
No, it does affect the debate over where to try terrorism suspects, the debate that's been going on since Bush first established military commissions in 2001, is where is it appropriate to try terrorist suspects in federal civilian court or in military commissions. The Bush administration took the position that these individuals should be tried in military commissions because they're essentially warriors. They should be treated like warriors and not like common criminals. Of course, Eric Holder and President Obama wanted some detainees at Guantanamo to be tried in federal courts and others to be tried in military commissions. This decision gets a lot of attention, and people are playing it as a vindication of trying terrorism suspects in federal civilian courts. I don't think the verdict is a vindication of it, and you have to be very, very careful about this. If this shows that federal courts are superior, it's not because the jury returned a guilty verdict. It's because the process was fast, the process was efficient, the process got somebody from the filing of the indictment to the verdict of the jury in a year. When you compare that to the military commissions in Guantanamo, which have yet to try the five 9/11 defendants, which have yet to try the cold bombing suspect Nashiri, and this is 12 years after the World Trade Center attacks and 14 years after the Cole bombing incident. So I do think that it's a good illustration of the efficiency of the process in federal civilian court versus military commissions. The reason I say it doesn't presage the closing of Guantanamo is that the prosecutor down there only plans to try essentially the men who are already on trial, the six, the 5/11 defendants, as I mentioned, and Nashiri, who's the Cole bombing suspect. There have been eight convictions previously. You get six more. That's 14. Who knows when the six will be tried? This has been dragging on for years and years and years. Yet there is an ideological component to it. Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell, and Senator McCain today said, this doesn't prove anything. These guys should be tried in military commissions. And to me, even from their standpoint, it's kind of an odd position to take, considering that the processing of criminal defendants in terrorism-related cases goes much faster than it does in the military commissions. Now, it's sort of a ping-pong game in a certain sense. A couple of years ago, this ex-detainee, Ali Ahmed Galani, was tried in New York on charges relating to the embassy bombings in 1998. He was acquitted of all but one charge. And in a certain way, people who believe in federal courts were glad that he was convicted of something. And the people who believe in the military commissions cases said, gee whiz, he almost got off scot-free, and that's why we need military commissions. So each time something happens that sort of supports one guy's argument over another, there's a claim of victory. I'm glad that Attorney General Holder praised this decision. I'm glad as showing that the federal courts can process these cases. But I just have to remind everybody, and this is sort of a hindsight criticism, I suppose, that the Guantanamo detainees against whom the administration has charges could have begun being tried in federal court in 2010. You may remember that in November 2009, Attorney General Holder announced that six detainees would be tried in federal court. That's the 9/11, five and one other. And six will be tried in military commissions in Guantanamo. Well and good. But then there was a political firestorm, and Holder and Obama backpedaled. We could have had many prosecutions in federal court in the Southern District or anywhere else, but because there's this sort of ideological opposition to treating these men as ordinary criminals, we get a system in which the government really can't prosecute detainees. In an efficient way. Mm-hmm. But again, I just want to go back. I know I've been long-winded here, but I just want to go back and make the basic point that it's not that a guilty verdict was returned. Conviction isn't the measure. Fairness is the measure. I'm sure there'll be appeals here, but it clearly shows that federal courts can handle these prosecutions a lot better than military commissions.
Again, I'm speaking with David Reams, who's a human rights lawyer representing 16 Yemeni prisoners detained at Guantanamo. He's known for his litigation of human rights and civil liberties cases, including a First Amendment challenge to the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012. Well, when you talk about an ideological objection to trying these people in federal courts or in civilian courts, this goes back to how we were sort of wrong-footed from the beginning in this so-called war on terror. One, by calling it a war on terror. Two, by, in effect, George W. Bush and Dick Cheney elevated Obama and these cave-dwelling ragtag band of his as equal players on the world stage to the world's lone Superman.
I think you mean Osama.
Pardon?
I think you mean Osama.
Osama, sorry. Yeah, he elevated Osama bin Laden as an equal player on the world stage, and they've spent a fortune down in Guantanamo keeping these people. So It seems to me that the only ideological reasoning behind this is not to teach them as treat them as criminals, is that we somehow have to say that this is a real war and these are real warriors, which is a huge mistake in my mind.
I quite agree with you. And as I say, it's counterproductive, because by taking that ideological position, the end result is that people aren't being prosecuted for the crimes that they're charged with. And litigation is flying in every direction because these are new and untested proceedings. And it's just a mess. I'll give you an analogy. You have all of these Republicans saying, we've got to cut spending, we've got to cut spending. And yet, when it comes to Guantanamo, no expense is spared. They're holding these individual detainees for, I don't know, upwards of $1 million a year, when if they held them in federal prisons, it would be a quarter of that. And I'm not giving you exact numbers. I'm trying to give you an idea of the scale. But this is another example where ideology trumps reality.
So since we started off on the wrong foot, is there any way, is it just too much in the political DNA of the country to believe this war on terror and that this is the way to go? And are we still, you know, lusting for revenge, or haven't we at this point, enough time has passed for us to be a little more rational?
Well, I'm not a sociologist, but it seems to me that the hysteria and panic and anger and desire for revenge that you had in the first few years after 9/11 and after the invasion of Iraq has pretty much cooled. People have moved on to other things. Obama himself is treating this as a matter that should be tried in federal courts when he can. I think he's trying to take the nation off a war footing, as he said. But these Republicans, and many Democrats as well, continue to cling to this myth that it's a war. And I just hope that misconception is fading.
Well, this, I suppose, then, just in closing, this is at least a step in that direction, right? You're saying they're not going to, not all of the people in Guantanamo are not even allowing them to go on trial, but some may follow, right?
Yes, and if I can just interject one other point, and I realize we're closing. One of the other self-defeating points about trying men in the military commissions is that the military commissions have a more limited ability to try particular charges than federal courts do. The jurisdiction is narrower, so the prosecutor down there cannot prosecute them for material support, cannot prosecute them for conspiracy. Both of those charges were filed and prosecuted against this defendant in this case. So that's another reason to favor federal courts, a broader jurisdiction.
Well, David Reams, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with David Reams, who's a human rights lawyer representing 16 Yemeni prisoners detained at Guantanamo, a former partner at Covington & Burling. He is known for his litigation of human rights and civil liberties cases, including the First Amendment challenge to the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the effectiveness of EU and US sanctions on Putin's Russia. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thanks, Ian.
And a few subjects I wanted to touch with you. I read your blog at Informed Comment on President Obama using the press conference with the Dutch Prime Minister in The Hague to take a jab at Romney, where the president said, in answer to a question, with respect to Mr. Romney's assertion that Russia is our number one geopolitical foe, the truth of the matter is that America has got a whole lot of challenges. Russia is a regional power that is threatening some of its immediate neighbors, not out of strength, but out of weakness. That also, not only is Obama slapping down the Republican right, I think he's also taking a dig at Putin, isn't he?
Oh, yes. I mean, he's putting Putin in his place. It's been clear for some time that Obama feels that Putin has an undue swagger to him that sometimes is a PR problem for his administration, and I think he wanted to take him down a notch. But it is also just true. You know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, the United States was engaged in a global contest with the then Soviet Union, and it was going on virtually in every corner of the world, and that's not the case today.
So the president's on his way to Saudi Arabia, where he'll obviously be talking about Syria, but there's also a rumor that he's going to be talking about the Saudis, about using Saudi oil as a weapon against Russia. As you know, Juan, the Saudis who were angry with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979 opened up the oil spigots and drove down the price of global crude to $20 a barrel in the mid-1980s. And given how Russia is entirely dependent upon oil and gas to buy goods, to keep the standard of living and keep the people happy, apparently the Russian budget is such that if oil goes below $106 a barrel, they're in trouble. It's now at $107 a barrel. So if the Saudis could push it down to even $90 a barrel, they could cause Russia some serious problems.
Well, that's an interesting theory. I frankly, Ian, don't think there's much to it. The U.S. already asked Saudi to flood the market, which is what that's called when they increase their production. They asked them to flood the market to offset the sanctions on Iran. So because of U.S. Treasury Department sanctions and arm twisting and threats against South Korea and India and so forth, Iranian exports are down about 1 million barrels a day. Is quite a lot of oil was taken off the market that way. And the Saudis ramped up production to replace that so that the price didn't go through the roof. It did stay high. But, you know, our current, that oil is over $100 a barrel, is in large part owing to U.S. sanctions on Iran and taking that oil off the market. I don't personally believe the Saudis are capable of producing much more than they are now, over 10 million barrels a day, certainly on any kind of sustainable schedule. So I don't think that they can flood the market on Russia. And moreover, Russia's economic strength lies more in its gas exports than it does in its petroleum. And the other thing that you can't control when you try to flood the market that way as a geopolitical tool is demand. And as economies come back out of the 2008 crash, demand in India and elsewhere is growing rapidly. So the whole thing doesn't sound to me very likely or plausible.
So what do you think, though, is in the EU and US's toolbox? That's what they've been talking about in Brussels, how to sanction Russia. I imagine what the focus on is now is what can they do to deter Putin from invading eastern and southern Ukraine, which he appears poised to be. I talked to a independent defense analyst the other day in Moscow who's pretty convinced, at least he gives it an 80% chance, that Putin will strike sometime in mid-April because he wants to get it over with before the May 25th election, which will not go his way in Ukraine. And while the country's in disarray, he might be able to pull it off until they get their act together militarily. That, of course, would be a major escalation. But Obama's already warned about it and treated it as a very serious possibility. But I don't know what tools do they have to deter him if he's spent on pushing further into Ukraine.
They don't have many tools. The fact is that the United States and Europe are relatively powerless in this particular conflict. Ukraine is a Russian sphere of influence, and there's not very, very unlikely that there will be any military pushback. And so they can punish Russia in various ways, but they have to set it up in so that they don't punish themselves. And were they to boycott Russian gas, well, a third of European gas is from Russia, so you'd end up with freezing Europeans. And in the short term, that's really not a prospect. What you could do, and I suspect from what they've already done that this is the direction they'll go in, is just to interfere with Russian finance. The U.S. Treasury Department has enormous influence and power in world financial circles. You just make it difficult for the Russians to get paid for things that they sell, which is what they did to Iran. Already there's, you know, a question about whether MasterCard and Visa are going to be able to offer credit cards to Russians. You just, you know, annoy them in various ways. And it does have, it could shave, you know, a point or 2 points a year off of Russian economic growth in the next few years, which would hurt. But it's going to be something more subtle like that, in my view.
Again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt Invading the Middle East and Engaging the Muslim World. He also is the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com. And Juan, you were in Egypt just a couple of weeks ago. And there's no question that what's happening in Egypt is tied to Saudi Arabia. The Saudis are effectively keeping this military government afloat. I think $32 billion has so far been pledged or given. And what do you think Obama's going to be talking to the Saudi king about? I mean, the Saudis clearly, you know, one, they were furious with the Muslim Brotherhood, and they've even been threatening Qatar for supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. But now they've got a military government there that's to their liking, but it's not sustainable over the long term, surely.
Right. I think the Obama administration and Saudi Arabia have a number of outstanding bilateral issues. One is that Obama is convinced that a deal can be done with Iran that will eventuate in no Iranian nuclear weapons program, and the Iranians would be allowed to enrich to a very low level of 5% for fuel for their nuclear reactors. The Saudis, I think, like the Israelis, maintain the profoundest skepticism that such a deal is plausible with Iran. They want no enrichment, and so they're angry at Obama for this overture to Iran and this possibility of a deal, which will take a lot of pressure off of the Iranian economy and therefore make Iran a bigger player geopolitically in the Gulf. And they're, of course, a rival of Saudi Arabia. So the Saudis are not happy with Iran policy. They're not happy that Obama has more or less kept out of Syria. There may be some covert aid and training to rebel forces, but the rise of the extremist Al-Qaeda-linked groups in northern Syria has spooked the Americans. I don't think the Obama administration has done very much with Syria. And the Saudis want the Bashar al-Assad government in Damascus gone. They are very firmly supporting the rebellion. And so they're annoyed with Obama. They see him as, you know, soft on Iran and kind of disengaged from the major struggle in West Asia. And then Obama has been critical of the crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. I think Washington is afraid that you could drive large numbers of Egyptian Muslim brothers into the arms of al-Qaeda by this brutal policy. And the Saudis, on the other hand, are determined to see the Brotherhood wiped out, stamped out as a movement. They view it as a kind of radical, sectarian, Republican movement. They view it rather as the Austrian crown viewed the French Revolution in the 18th century. So there's no common ground there between the United States and Saudi Arabia on this policy.
Well, the Saudis, of course, are not just disappointed in the U.S. over Syria. They're also angry with Russia. And I'm just wondering, again, I know that you've made a good point that the Saudis may not have the swing capacity to flood the oil market with more oil because of the doing so to keep Iranian oil off the market. So they may not have enough to affect the price of oil in Russia. But over the long term, it would seem that if Putin goes further, in the end of the day, it'll come back to bite him because the Europeans will find ways to diversify. Qatar, of course, is a huge LNG source. Do you think that at least there's conversations that will be going on with the Saudis about a long-term strategy vis-a-vis squeezing the Russian energy market?
Well, I mean, certainly that's possible, but remember also that if the Saudis pump more oil, even if they were capable of doing so, and made it cheaper, they're cheating themselves, and they have to decide whether they want to harm themselves in order to harm Russia. It's also the case that, you know, this game can be played both ways. So if Russia cut back on its production, it would reduce supply. And so, you know, there's a sense in which taking oil off the market is a very complex game. It can actually raise the price so that you end up getting more for your oil. And in some ways, Iran has been held harmless from these enormous petroleum sanctions, in part because at over $100 a barrel, even if they're only exporting 1.5 million barrels a day, they're still raking in the money hand over fist. So there are things Russia could do to offset Saudi extra production. But as I said, I just don't think that the Saudis are capable of putting that much more oil on the market. I think the Saudis do, you know, have a vendetta with the Russians over Syria. It is said that a Saudi prince, Bandar bin Sultan, went to Moscow and offered the Russians an enormous aid package if only they would abandon Damascus. But I think the thing to remember is about Saudi Arabia is that it's a small country, citizen population probably on the order of 23 million. It doesn't have a military to speak of, and it does have, you know, maybe $800 billion in reserves. This is money it doesn't need to run its government. It doesn't have anything else it has to do with it, so it can spend it on, you know, geopolitical projects like buying Egypt and crushing the Muslim Brotherhood, or funding a rebellion in Syria. But it's just cash, and it doesn't go that far in world affairs.
Well, Juan Cole, in buying Egypt and funding this military government, as I mentioned earlier, it doesn't seem to be, in the long term, a sustainable strategy. But the reason that they're doing it is, apart from their vendetta against the Muslim Brotherhood and by extension Qatar for supporting them, their real reason is that they don't want any other models of Islamic government taking off and being successful compared to their incredibly reactionary and feudal system that they have. And that would seem to me, over the long term, equally a losing proposition. I mean, one of the things that's happening in the build-up to Obama's visit to Saudi Arabia is Amnesty International have sent a letter to Obama urging him to have female Secret Service agents drive him around while he's in Saudi Arabia. It's not likely that the U.S. will ever even bring up human rights issues with Saudi Arabia. At least that hasn't been, they haven't done it in the past, just from my recollection. So what's your sense of what the Saudi motives are of spending this cash, and how long can they maintain this medieval form of government where there's no parliament, nothing, and no democracy, not even a vestige of it, and everybody's completely dependent upon the largesse of the king?
Yes, well, analysts of the Gulf region back in the late 60s, when South Yemen went communist, and Fred Halliday at the London School of Economics was amongst them, speculated that these regimes couldn't last, and Fred wrote a book called Arabia Without Sultans, which I think came out in the early 70s. And I fear to say that Fred is no longer with us and the sultans are still there. So it may well be that they are fragile and won't last forever, but whatever they've got going seems to have some legs, and you can't predict that they'll be gone anytime soon. I think, you know, the thing to keep in mind is that Saudi citizens, Kuwaiti citizens, the citizens of these oil states, although Kuwait politically is very different from Saudi Arabia, it has an elected parliament and so forth, but they are able to offer their citizens education for free through the PhD, free health care, where they don't have any cavils about Obamacare, and all kinds of economic opportunities because of the oil wealth. There are many guest workers who come who often have to become silent partners of citizens. You can't get citizenship if you're an outsider at all. And so if you want to work, you want to be a cab driver or open a shop in Saudi Arabia, you often have to get a Saudi silent partner. So, much of the country is pretty well off and benefiting economically from this system. And whatever the king is doing is not annoying them to that extent. And it's sad to say that the Saudis are not the worst human rights abusers in the region. I mean, you've got thousands of people killed in Syria and so forth. So they think they can keep this going this way. With regard to Egypt, I think the Saudis really were afraid, as you said, of the Muslim Brotherhood government of Mohamed Morsi in Egypt last year. And Saudi Arabia had been invaded by Egypt in the 19th century, and they have never forgotten that. And I think they saw, you know, a rival Muslim-based system as deadly to their interests, and so they wanted it gone. And, of course, it was linked to their rival, Qatar. So they actually prefer a relatively secular nationalist government in Egypt, which is what the generals promote, over political Islam in Egypt. It's quite ironic. But that political Islam in Egypt, you know, has a Republican tinge with a small R and is somewhat hostile to monarchy. And the Saudis feel that they can survive in a world of, you know, sister republics, but they can't survive in a world where the republics are also Islamically based and form an ideological challenge to their own claim to be guardians of Mecca and Medina and of Islamic values. So they've, there are many ironies in all this that the Saudis are afraid of political Islam. After having pushed it so hard in so many places for so long, and are now involved in wiping it out in Egypt and really strengthening secular forces, both liberal and leftist. Egyptians, when I was there, seemed to me to be very happy to see the the Muslim Brotherhood gone. They felt that it was moving in a puritanical and theocratic direction that was contrary to Egyptian values. And they feel like they can party again. They're happy with the personal freedoms they feel they've gained, even though it is a military dictatorship. They also have a kind of hero worship of this General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who seems on the verge of declaring his candidacy for presidency, and it seems that he has the popularity to win such a contest. So it's a human rights situation is dire, and people are locked up for really minor thought crimes or protests. It's quite ironic that in Egypt there are people now in jail for protesting after the revolution of 2011. Mm. But the economy is not doing well. All of that money that the Gulf pledged that you mentioned really seems to be spent on current account. Sisi says that he thinks the country needs on the order of $200 or $300 billion in investment in infrastructure. And I think he thinks he can get it from Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, from the oil monarchies of the Gulf. And in return, Sisi is going to offer them the Egyptian military as their security umbrella against Iran and Iraq. He thinks he can make a really big deal in that regard.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Juan Cole.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog informcomment@juancole.com. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the likely consequences of a Supreme Court ruling in favor of a Christian family-owned business who want to opt out of the Affordable Care Act. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elizabeth Wydra, who's the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Wydra.
It's great to be with you.
And you were in the Supreme Court yesterday hearing the arguments over whether or not corporations can opt out of the Affordable Care Act's mandate on providing contraceptives to the female employees. There's a great concern that this ruling, if it goes in favor of the Hobby Lobby Christian company and the Mennonite company, whose position is a little more limited but nevertheless similar, that this could open a Pandora's box that could be catastrophic.
Yeah, absolutely. This case is an important case about contraception and women's access to health care in the particular case, but it is much more than just about contraception. If Hobby Lobby prevails on its claim that it can use the religious beliefs of the individuals who own the company to exempt a commercial enterprise from laws that apply to everyone else, then we could see companies trying to avoid paying for important treatments like vaccinations, blood transfusions, stem cell treatments, and then even beyond healthcare, companies trying to exempt themselves from crucial anti-discrimination laws that require treating women and men equally and require equal treatment of gay men and lesbians. So while the case itself is important just on its own facts, when you think about the possible implications, then this is a really, really big deal.
So in terms of what you just mentioned, Elizabeth Wydra, about gay and lesbian rights being infringed by if this ruling goes in favor of Hobby Lobby, we already had an example of that in Arizona where a law was vetoed by the governor, even though she had a part in promulgating it in the first place. It resulted in a great deal of pressure from the business community, but it would seem to me to be a perfectly logical analogy to this case before the Supreme Court with Hobby Lobby, and that law in Arizona is making its way through various legislatures across the country. So if the Supreme Court opens the door, surely we'll have businesses can discriminate on the personal political beliefs of their owners to customers and to the world at large.
Absolutely, and there's actually already a case that's working its way up to the Supreme Court out of New Mexico. There was a wedding photographer who refused to take photographs for gay couples' weddings. So this is already happening, and they refused to do so on the basis of their religious beliefs. So this is something that's already happening, and you know it isn't just something that's abstract or hypothetical. It's something that we should be concerned about. And, you know, that's just not the way that the law has worked. And it shouldn't be the way that it works in the future. But I got to say, after sitting there and listening to the arguments, I am really concerned that there might be a majority of justices on the Supreme Court who are going to vote that way.
And how much did the law that was signed by Bill Clinton, which was mentioned on a number of times in the hearings before the Supreme Court, how much do you think that has given them cover in terms of those that might well rule in favor of Hobby Lobby?
Well, you know, there's never been in the history of the United States an instance in which a commercial enterprise like Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood, the other company, its cabinet maker, there's never been an instance in our nation's history in which a commercial enterprise has gotten an exemption from a generally applicable law that would burden the rights of others. So there is no cover for the Supreme Court to do this, but that doesn't mean that they won't. They actually pushed back against the Solicitor General's argument when he pointed out that there has never been a case in which the court has done this, essentially saying that, you know, well, this could be the first one. And so there's no support in Supreme Court precedent. There's no support in our constitutional tradition for allowing our principles of religious liberty to be used in this way, especially when they would burden the rights and liberties of third parties. I mean, even if you think about the facts of this case, Hobby Lobby has, you know, about 13,000 employees across the country, and we're talking about a statutorily granted right that the women employees have to the full range of FDA-approved contraception. And just because they work for Hobby Lobby or Conestoga Wood, it doesn't mean that they checked their personal rights, their liberty, at the door of the workplace.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, who's the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. And the Religious Freedoms Restoration Act that I referred to, obviously it did come up. But the other thing that came up in these arguments was it seems that Plan B is what's got some of the conservative justices upset. And that's the argument that seemed to have been made, that somehow Plan B and IUDs are a form of abortion. What was your reading on that kind of argument and its implications? Because that, Plan B was tested. It took forever to get that drug on the market. It's proven incredibly effective and incredibly safe. They fought that tooth and nail, and And, you know, what we feel, a lot of people feel about this case is that we thought the Affordable Care Act was settled by the Supreme Court. Now the doors are opened, and now they're having another shot at Plan B by the look of it.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because the particular contraceptives being challenged are ones that the business owners believe prevent implantation of a fertilized egg, which they consider to be equivalent to abortion. That's not the way that federal law defines abortion. And in fact, the science on whether or not these forms of contraception actually prevent implantation of a fertilized egg at best is ambiguous, but I think you could even probably go further, and some of the medical groups that filed friend of the court briefs in the court went further to say that, you know, they don't actually prevent implantation of a fertilized egg. But the Solicitor General raised a really good point in the argument when the justices, some of the more conservative justices, made the point that this case is about abortion. He said, you know, there are more than 2 million women across the country who use IUDs, and I don't think that they consider themselves to be engaging in abortion. And I think that's an important reality check, because having the full range of FDA-approved contraception covered by the Affordable Care Act, allowing all of those forms of contraception to be available to women without a copay, is important because that allows the woman and her doctor to come up with what is going to be the safest and most effective form of contraception for her. And in many cases, that will be an IUD, which is generally shown to be much more effective and much safer than some other forms of contraception. But the IUD also happens to be the most expensive, with an upfront cost that is higher than other forms. And so if that form isn't covered but other forms of contraception are, then studies show, and it's frankly just common sense, that the cost differential will drive the decision and not necessarily what is best for the health of that woman and in the best interest of her and her family.
But in general, this whole case feels like the pot calling the kettle black. If you take the Arizona case against not serving gays in restaurants because of the restaurant's owner's religious beliefs, who's imposing what on who? The religious right is arguing that homosexuals are imposing their lifestyle simply for being alive, for being who they are. I mean, their very presence apparently is an imposition of their lifestyle, according to that logic. But on the other hand, it seems so much more clear to me, at least, that these are people who are imposing their religious beliefs on the rest of us. And the idea that you could destroy the Affordable Care Act or gut it, an important part of it, based upon the religious feelings of one or two companies in the United States is pretty preposterous.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that it really does turn on its head the idea of religious liberty to say that you can have the a business entity, which has never been understood to share in the protection of religious freedom in the same way that living, breathing individuals do, but to have that corporation be able to impose religious beliefs on employees who may have very different views and are entitled to have different views. You know, these companies, as opposed to like a church or a synagogue or a more explicitly religious organization, they don't hire on the basis of religion. They don't have an exemption from the federal anti-discrimination laws that require companies to hire without regard to religion. And so there are lots of people who are going to work there who don't share in the religious beliefs of the Green family that owns Hobby Lobby. But you're absolutely right that if the court rules in favor of Hobby Lobby, it will amount to the Green family, the owners of Hobby Lobby, being able to impose their religious beliefs on the employees. And that goes squarely against Supreme Court precedent, which has clearly said that the limitations that a person personally accepts on his conduct as a result of his religious faith cannot be imposed when you voluntarily enter into the commercial sphere. It cannot be imposed on others. That's just not the way that things work. If you don't want to, if you want to be a business owner, you have to apply by generally applicable laws, especially when the rights of others are involved. You know, if you want to take those limitations on your own conduct as a result of your faith, that's great. And in fact, you're protected in your ability to do that. But it really does turn the idea of religious freedom on its head to say that a corporation can then turn around and, you know, when you expected to show up for work to sell craft supplies, instead you're checking your religious liberty at the workplace door.
But doesn't this fly in the face of there should be no religious test? I mean, isn't that fundamental in our Constitution?
Well, there is. So the First Amendment protects religious free exercise, and it also protects against government establishment of religion.
Right.
And there have been arguments, and Justice Ginsburg raised this point in oral argument yesterday, that if the government allows Hobby Lobby to do this, could that raise a problem under the Establishment Clause? Could that be implicating the idea that by the government allowing religious people who own for-profit entities to opt out of these laws, could that be establishing religion? And so that's something that's on the table and that the court is going to have to grapple with.
Well, one of the things that, to my mind, or at least my understanding, Elizabeth Wider, that restricts corporations from imposing their personal and religious beliefs on their customers, and to some extent, Domino's Pizza, the guy that runs that, is a very fundamentalist Catholic, and he's even built a kind of Truman Show little town down in Florida, you know, the perfect little Christian community. But even he's restrained because he knows that he wants to sell to as many customers as possible. The same applies to our convention in the press, where you always have to have the Republican argument and then the Democratic argument. In the universe of discourse, there's only two black and white opinions. And that comes out of not out of fair and balanced, as Fox News likes to say. That comes out of the fact that the owners of the media know that half of their readers and television viewers are either Democrats or Republicans. So in order not to offend either, we have this kind of bland approach to politics and news and the coverage of politics. So you can see how we've been restrained by logic, by a kind of commercial logic on the part of corporate owners. But I take it with Hobby Lobby and perhaps the Mennonite Company, they're not so much restricted because most of their customers are like-minded. Are they living in a little Christian bubble? Is that what's going on here?
You know, I don't know. I don't know if that's their customer base. You know, people are free to conduct their businesses differently in many ways, but when they run up against laws that require a different course of conduct, then their business practices have to yield to those generally applicable laws in most instances. So, for example, Hobby Lobby, they do run their business in accordance with their Christian principles. They like to, they close their doors on Sundays. They play Christmas music. And those things are not forbidden by law, and so it's fine that Hobby Lobby wants to do that. But when there is a law that applies to them, like if they choose to offer health insurance, that health insurance plan meets certain minimum requirements, and it's not just about contraception. There are many different requirements that if a company offers employer-sponsored health plans, that they have to meet these minimum requirements. When the law says that, if you choose to offer health insurance, then you have to abide by that law. Now, I would note that, you know, Hobby Lobby has framed this as sort of their being required to pay for these forms of contraception, but that's actually a mischaracterization of the law. They could choose not to offer employer-sponsored health insurance, and instead they would pay a tax, and so then their employees would go on to the exchanges established by the Affordable Care Act, and if they were lower income, they would get subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. And so Hobby Lobby has a choice about whether or not to offer insurance that would then cover these forms of contraception or to pay the tax instead. And in fact, as Justice Kagan brought out really strongly yesterday in oral argument with Hobby Lobby's lawyer, this isn't burdensome for Hobby Lobby. In fact, it would probably be cheaper for them if they chose to pay the tax instead of offering health insurance. So their sort of claim that they are being forced to either violate their religious beliefs or suffer this extraordinarily financial penalty, that's just simply wrong.
And that was, of course, Justice Sotomayor's point to Roberts, who seemed to agree it's not called a penalty, it's called a tax. I mean, that is obviously the simple way out, and that's what the law provides. So the feeling you get here is not only is there a kind of evangelical hubris going on here. My understanding from speaking yesterday to some people from RH Reality Check is that they've done investigative journalism looking into how this case got there to the Supreme Court in the first place. And you know, Elizabeth Wider, there's this phenomenon called Supreme Court shopping, where cases are tailored to get to the Supreme Court, like the Washington, D.C. Gun case that ended up turning the Second Amendment on its head. So they were telling me yesterday that there's a real line there from the Koch brothers and funding through their front groups to the lawyers in this case. So is this a stealth way for the Koch brothers, who've been opposed to the Affordable Care Act from the beginning, to get their way using the sanctimony of religion?
Well, you know, I'm not sure about that. You know, I certainly would not. I don't question the sincere beliefs of these particular business owners.
Well, it's not so much the business owners I'm referring to. It's how the case got to the courts and who paid its way.
It's certainly true that the plaintiffs they chose to bring the case are very sympathetic. And, you know, the justices pointed that out actually yesterday, that, you know, this was a smart way to bring your case. And that's what people do when they want their, you know, you choose the best vehicle to get your argument across. And, you know, I think it might be interesting to the public to know how it got there. But frankly, that's just smart lawyering.
I see. Well, Elizabeth Wider, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Wider, who's the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.